Savior, may I learn to love thee, walk the path that thou hast shown. Pause to help and lift another, finding strength beyond my own.
Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at GayMormonStories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Danny Parkinson for our next installment of Gay Mormon Stories. Today, I am meeting with Keaton Johnson. He is a young man who was raised Mormon and is gay. And I heard about him because I had learned this year about his partner, whose name is Randy Roberts Potts, which I have trouble saying. Randy Roberts Potts might not be that famous to Mormons because we aren't into the evangelical scene as much, but he is the grandson of Oral Roberts, and he became quite well known and created a major scandal when he came out as gay. And he's also become an activist to try to increase acceptance of gay people within these evangelical Christian denominations. And so Randy was born into activism, obviously, by being the grandson of a famous person who also happens to be gay, and he did rise to the occasion to really promote the cause of LGBT well-being, especially within Christianity. But I'm particularly interested in talking to Keaton for some other reasons that we'll get to, but one of those is that he and Randy are married, and Keaton is being a stepfather to Randy's three children, and this is always one thing I like to do in my podcast is point out the different ways that people do make families, different way gay peoples do, and how important marriage is, especially same-sex marriage in the context of these families. So I appreciate Keaton taking the time to talk to me. He hasn't sought out publicity personally, and so for him it was a really generous of him to be willing to be public in this way when in his life he has to try fight to preserve his privacy. So I really appreciate it, Keaton. And why don't you say hello and we'll start asking you questions about your life.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here and terrified to be here at the exact same time. It's the first interview I've ever done. So I'm just excited to tell my alleged gay Mormon story and
your so-called gay story.
Yes, my so-called gay story.
Yeah, or so-called homosexual, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you're supposed to use the word gay. It's softer sounding than homosexual, less cold and calculating.
But when you're being a so-called homosexual, which one?
Yes. Of course.
Anyway, maybe you haven't listened to General Conference lately, but anyway, that's
I get
layers of nuance here.
I get brief updates. I still have some family that are practicing Mormons, and my dad is for sure. So,
okay.
I get some of the good juicy highlights.
Okay. Well, let's start with, you probably don't know our format, but I'll just tell you a little bit, and while I tell the others, that I really do a biographical interview, and I like to really start at the beginning. And you might not have that much to tell me about your earliest days, but maybe you do. And so I just want to start by asking you what kind of a Mormon family you were born into and what's your Mormon heritage?
Oh my goodness. Well, the Mormon family I was born into, my mom and dad got married, and I might be a little hazy on some of the details of my childhood. I think I repressed most of it. And I don't know if it's entirely the Mormon's fault, but there's definitely a, you know, hand that was played there. But they got divorced pretty quickly, I think when I was around 3 or 4. And my dad was a practicing Mormon, and my mom refused to convert. So that created a little bit of tension. And after they got divorced, my brother and I were it was in the divorce decree that we get carted off to church every Sunday for, you know, the good old 4 hours or something of worship. So that's pretty much how Mormonism played a role in my childhood.
But were you being raised by your mother then?
I was, it was 50-50 custody at first.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I went every other week, mom to dad, but every Sunday for sure we were in church on time.
Okay, regardless of which parent you were staying with, you were...
Oh yeah, it doesn't matter which parent we were with, we were at church.
Does that mean that your mother, even though she wasn't a member, was attending with you?
No, she let us go with dad.
Okay, and you lived close enough that it wasn't like...
Yeah, same city,
all the way across town.
Just up the street. They made their best effort at co-parenting, and it was good to go to church every Sunday. I at least got something out of it.
Yeah, and where did you grow up?
Dallas, Texas.
So kind of, your mom and dad were living in Dallas.
Yes.
So would you say then that your childhood... You were living between your mom and your dad's house. You have an older brother?
I had an older brother. He died about 4 years ago.
How much older than you was he?
He was 2 years older than me.
And it was just the two of you?
It was just the two of us. My mom eventually remarried pretty quickly, actually. She had an affair on my father. And the man that she ended up with was the man she had an affair with. And he had three kids. So I grew up... I was raised with three step-siblings, but they were... I believe every other weekend, or maybe just one weekend a month. So they were always around one weekend a month, and we'd always have, you know, family time for that whole weekend. But it's hard to say that I actually grew up with them. But I love them to death.
Were they similar in age to you, or
they were
in ages?
His youngest was just a little bit older than Tyson, so we were almost like a perfect line, you know.
Oh, okay.
Sort of,
yeah.
A nice crescendo of children.
Yeah. And you were spending half and half between your mom and your dad. Did your dad remarry too?
He did not, no.
And you were attending church. Did you like it? You liked primary? You liked your church experience?
No, not really. It was nice to have a place to belong, and it was nice to have that stability in place. You go every week, and people ask you how you are, and everyone's interested. And, you know, looking back, it sort of seems like a weird little Stepford convention, because... Everybody, you know, was just so nice and almost blank-faced. But after a little while, I would be daunted by the amount of hours you would actually spend in that building. And I figured out pretty quickly that the whole point seemed to be try and be a good person. And if you're not a good person, if you do something bad, it's okay, try again. To be a good person the next time you're in one of those situations, and if you don't do it then, it's okay. But as long as you're actively trying to better yourself and be kind to your fellow men, then you're pretty much good with life. And it seemed like the rest of it was just a little silly pretty quickly for me.
But are you talking in your childhood, or was this more in your adolescence?
This was really in my childhood. I kind of got...
So even in your childhood, you had some sort of... base, it wasn't resonating with you that much, even as a child.
No, I did a lot of soul searching later in my life, which I assume we'll get into at some point later in the interview.
Yeah.
I just had a different relationship with God, and I didn't know it. That was pretty much all it was. It just, you know, takes a whole bunch of life and time to figure out where you're at, and it's going to always evolve. So I just...
Would you say that your attitude about it was different than your brothers, or were the two of you kind of in sync?
That's really hard to say. Tyson was extraordinarily intellectual, and he thought everything through. I was the lazy younger brother that wanted to sit around and play video games all day. And he did so much reading and, you know, really trying to search the intellectual side of religion. And he and I were not close until about 2 years before he died, so we actually didn't really talk about it all that much.
So,
but
would you say your father, though, was pretty devout Mormon?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Extraordinarily so. And honestly, he's one of the few people that has allowed me to maintain faith in Mormonism as a whole. I don't personally, you know, my beliefs are mine, but I love to see people who really walk the walk and talk the talk and try to apply themselves. They're not just going for a social function. And he really, I mean, he is so committed to his faith. And he knows a lot about it, and he's very invested in it. And that makes me proud of him, to be honest.
So as a child, you saw him as being devout, and even then you recognized that this was an issue of integrity for him, that he was being really true to his faith.
Oh, for sure.
Okay, well, let me just ask you a little bit about your childhood other than that. Would you say that, just sort of the typical questions a gay... I just wonder if how typical your experience was as a gay person or things that might be, common, such as, would you say that you were a rough and tumble kid, or were you a sensitive kid, or were you into sports, or were you into music?
Oh, I was so sensitive. I was. I tried to play the peacekeeper between my two parents, because they had a sort of, hostile divorce, and especially towards the first, decade of it. And I just always tried to make sure both parents were happy and pleased, and I tried to spend time with them. I was also a brat, but that was besides the point. I tried really hard to make
brat.
Sure everyone was good. A sensitive brat.
Okay.
But, I mean, I have so many standard gay stories. My dad took my My Little Ponies away when I was probably about six, and I was miserably depressed.
That's standard.
I know. He replaced them with X-Men and Power Rangers, so I was grateful. And Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, of course, but no more My Little
Ponies. You liked those, huh? You liked the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, at least. You weren't too deprived.
No, I didn't feel too deprived. I kind of wish they had, noble steeds to ride into battle, but, you can't have everything you want.
Yeah. And if it helps, one of the voices of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in all the movies is a gay Mormon. Or a gay ex-Mormon,
you
might say, Cam Clark. He was the original Jimmy Flinders in Saturday's Warrior, and I'm really hoping he'll do an interview with me one day. But anyway, just so you know, there was a gay, at least voice, to a fictional character.
That may be the coolest thing I've ever heard. Yeah. He was my hero, and I didn't even know it.
Well, there you go. Well, and actually, he is a hero to a lot of people. I mean, that ends up, resonating with young people when they're struggling. Knowing the voice of one of your favorite turtles is gay makes a difference to you. So, but anyway, that's an aside. Would you say that that things like the My Little Pony, did it cause distress for your parents? Were they concerned, oh my goodness, he's doing things that little girls like, or was it not that big of a deal?
I don't think so. I think I am extraordinarily fortunate to have grown up without that struggle of, I think my parents might disown me if they find out I'm gay. Even my father, I knew that he'd love me no matter what, and he was just trying to direct me to be the kid that he thought was going to send me to have a happy, healthy life, and, he could have made better decisions, of course, but it's almost an impossible job. So, no, I just don't think that they were really trying hard. My mom, for sure. They probably just knew. And my family, especially, and I think it might be a sickness throughout the Mormon faith, but we just didn't talk about it, about anything personal.
That's America, but
yeah. Yeah, well, there you go.
Well, I know this because I'm married to a Latino, but...
congratulations.
What about your school experience? Did you fit in easily socially, or did you have bullying, or how was that for you, your early years?
Oh, no.
Elementary school.
No, the first two-thirds of my scholastic career were spent at a private school that was predominantly Jewish, and I was the only Mormon kid, and I was also the only kid with divorced parents. I was the first one before the deluge of divorces happened a couple years down the road, I didn't have a lot of friends. The friends I did have were sort of nerdy, and they would get kind of sucked in, I think, to the drama that was going on in my personal life, and then they just stopped being friends with me. And so I spent a lot of solitary time for a lot of my school years, really until about high school.
So when you say drama, you just mean your family drama would sort of... This would impact how you'd relate to your peers?
I was so young that it's hard to say. It's really all speculation. I'm just kind of assuming that I hadn't done anything to make them not like me, but I just sort of lost all my friends.
Where I went to school, all the little boys, they liked sports, and they like doing all these things I didn't like to do. I mean, was this?
Oh,
was
I had
this,
to do.
Which is also
I was in four different kinds of Little League, and year round, and you know when it was when team sports were put in as an option, I got to do football and lacrosse, and I was miserable every second of it. So.
Oh, okay.
I got to experience that stuff.
were you miserable because you were just not good at it, or were you just miserable because you didn't like it? Or
both? I didn't like it at all. And I started gaining a lot of weight when I was probably around 6 or 7, and I got all the way up to 280 pounds by the time I was 16, 17. And so I kept to myself. I was so lucky to really not be in a environment where there was a lot of bullying, though. It must have been a good generation, and I was just sort of excluded, but I wasn't singled out, and I wasn't a target for anyone, so I've had a very, very lucky gay Mormon experience.
Well, that's true. It's much better to be ignored than to be persecuted, so...
Yes.
It sounds like that particular private school was a good place for you to be. Maybe your parents, why did they choose that school?
They wanted me to have a good education, and it actually was a pretty liberal school, and their approach towards education was fairly liberal. So it was just a good school. It was right up the road, and they made the decision together, but yeah, it was good to get there.
And your brother went to the same school?
Yes, he completed. I pretty much stopped doing schoolwork at one point, and... came to a mutual decision with the faculty and myself and my parents that it was time for me to move to a different school. And so my sophomore year of high school is when I transferred.
Well, let's come to that. But let's talk about your adolescence a little bit, your early teen years.
Fun stuff.
So you said that your childhood was sort of plagued by the problem of being overweight, or became a problem that was really impacting you socially.
Yeah, the divorce and the heft were probably my two biggest problems. It's funny, I don't remember specifically how I found out what to be gay was. I can't remember the moment, but I remember the feeling, and the instant I figured out what it was, I knew that it defined one part of me, and I knew that I just needed to keep it quiet for the foreseeable future. But I was so lucky, I never tried to deny it, I never tried to hide it from myself.
So how old were you when you feel like this occurred to you, that you were gay?
It probably occurred to me around 11 or 12. My memory of especially my early childhood is really fuzzy. So it's hard for me to sort of...
You kind of recall... how old are you now? Do you mind?
28.
28? Because I'm trying to kind of put... sort of a perspective on it as to what was going on in our country at the time when you were 12 years old. So I'm trying to do some math here. That was 16 years ago. Okay, so 1998 or so. So I'm trying to think if Will and Grace was already on TV then.
I don't know if it was when I was 12, though. I remember so vividly watching the first episode of Will and Grace, though. It was a Friday night or... some night I was alone, and it was one of those nights where I knew that I should have been out doing things with friends, but I didn't have any friends to do anything with. So I turned the television on, and the sitcom started, and I had had no experience with gay people, hardly ever. And it just sort of all came into perspective, and it was just completely serendipitous that I turned on the television at that time for the, you know, series premiere of that show. And I watched a couple episodes. I was a little transfixed, but then I discovered Queer as Folk, and I was like, you know, Will and Grace is for boring people.
Yeah, but it's interesting that, you know, I'm trying to think of what sort of information would be available to someone, because, you know, obviously in my generation, we had nothing. I mean, there was just an occasional newspaper article about these crazy gays in San Francisco, but but it wasn't enough to get it on my radar as a real thing. But somehow when you were 11 or 12, there had been enough sort of examples, or somehow you knew that gay existed.
It just wasn't ever discussed. And my parents were not current event people in the least, so the news wasn't around me in any form or facet. And I didn't have access to the sort of information about those things. So, no, I didn't have a lot of examples. I was kind of feeling around in the dark.
Yeah. Did you participate in Scouts and in Deacon's Quorum and all that
stuff? I did. Scouts, I did. As far as Mormons, the Mormon thing goes, I was baptized a priest, and that was as far as I got. I never did the seminary classes, and I never made it to the mission stake president to talk about my mission. I knew pretty early that I didn't want to go on a mission.
So throughout the course of your adolescence, you got further and further from your attachment to the religion.
Yeah, well, I really got detached from the religion when my dad went to prison for the first time. So without him making sure that I went every single Sunday, I still continued to go, and I tried to keep up with it, but it was mostly just because I wanted him to be happy. I knew he was probably terrified where he was and was going through something very serious. So I tried to keep going, but, you know, to try and get a kid that's probably at that point I was 11 or 12 to go to church every Sunday autonomously by yourself, my brother had stopped going at that point. It's just, okay. I mean, I'm surprised I went as long as I did.
So your father went to prison. Do you want to tell us what that was about, or
sure,
or not to?
It was credit card fraud, I believe, or financial fraud of some sort. It was fairly minor, and I love my dad very much, and he struggled throughout my childhood to sort of get it together and figure out how to be. It's funny because I see it in Randy with how he raises his kids, is it's just nonstop work. And I think Dad really struggled with finding a balance between being a father and being as involved as he wanted to be and being able to bring in enough money to provide the lifestyle that we'd grown accustomed to. And I mean, he made a bad decision, and that was that.
And this sent him to jail, though.
This sent him to jail. I believe it was... I want to say it was 16 months. It was over a year for sure.
So when that happened, I guess you just stayed with your mother, obviously.
Yes, full custody, my mom and my stepdad. Okay.
And then that started to impact your church attendance, obviously. So
yes, and looking back, I really remember people in the church coming up and it's funny, I didn't really ever feel like anyone was concerned about me and my happiness and well-being and emotional stability as a kid that they'd known since I was, you know, in a carriage, little stroller guy. They didn't seem to be concerned at all. They seemed to want to know the story so they could gossip. And I remember feeling a lot of resentment towards them for that.
Yeah.
So it was sort of a combination of the two.
Did you, you know, a lot of, you know, young people at that time are also sort of getting, that's when you start getting bombarded with the, or we used to at least getting bombarded with the messages about chastity and masturbation porn and all that stuff. Was this part of your experience too that was also relevant? Or
yeah, I looking back, it's so much fun to remember those meetings that you had to go in one-on-one with the bishop, and he asks you those questions, you know, do you have impure thoughts? Do you masturbate? And, you know, every kid that goes in there says no, and there's about 90% of them were lying. So I remember those very well.
And was this traumatic for you, though?
Oh, yeah. Because I was having those thoughts, and I thought they were evil. I mean, but me, I was never concerned about the gayness of my thoughts. I was concerned about the quality of them. And, you know, when you're a 12-year-old kid, you just start thinking about it.
Okay, so you're just having the basic guilt that every Mormon boy has about being obsessed with sex, like every 12-year-old, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's this new exciting thing to think about that is extraordinarily dynamic, and, you know, it's like Legos. You just...
Okay.
12-year-old boys.
So, meanwhile, in your life, it was still a secret. It was still... it was just this awareness you had as far as being gay, but it wasn't really playing a role other than you... Were you thinking that this was just something you certainly could never tell anybody, or...?
I didn't much think about it. It was just... I figured it was my nature. You know, when I first started fantasizing, I'd think about a boy with a girl because that's the only thing I'd known about or been, you know, seen on television. It was always a man with a woman. And so that's how when I would think about sex when I was that age, that's what I would think about. But, you know, you start realizing that you're only really focusing on the guy in your imagination. And then you're like, well, if I took this girl out and put a guy there, and then you're very happy. And I just, I never tried to fight it. I never thought it was really all that bad. I didn't think I was wrong. I thought the thoughts were wrong because they were dirty thoughts, but I didn't think the gayness of them was much of a problem, to be honest. I never worried about it. I was very lucky.
Okay.
I don't know how that response came to me.
Yeah, well, I'm guessing that this must have just exacerbated the situation with your father. Must have been highly stressful for you, and even further sort of complicated your functioning at school and at church. Was that the case?
It's hard to remember. I assume so. I kind of stopped doing homework. I didn't want to study. I only wanted to learn about the things that I was interested in and not what the school was teaching me. And I was probably lashing out or maybe crying for help. I don't know. I was definitely guilty of burying every single feeling I had ever had. So just...
And you said that your father went to jail more than once?
He did go to jail more than once.
Did this happen again then during your adolescence?
Yes. There was another instance of fraud.
So this was kind of then repeating. And it sounds like your schoolwork deteriorated to the point where you all decided to switch schools. So did you switch to a different private school or did you decide to go to the public school at that time?
Well, I was shopped out to a couple different private schools, but I thought it was a little fruitless because I had terrible grades and I didn't think they would accept me. And they even tried to get me into a school for kids with learning disabilities. And at that point, I just kind of told them, listen, I think I'd be better off at public school. I don't know if I want to be in private school anymore. I tried to get my mom to transfer me in the middle of at private school. It was trimesters, so... Basically, in the middle of the year, and the only time I've ever caught her lying to me, and I genuinely think it's the only time my mom has ever lied to me, was when she told me that they wouldn't accept me halfway through the school year. You have to start at public school in the beginning. She did it for my own good, I'm sure, but that's the only time I can remember it. But I wanted to go to public school.
So what happened?
I got to go to public school, and I was transferred from a predominantly Jewish private school to a predominantly Black public school, so... Oh. I further honed my craft of being comfortable, you know, being somebody that totally stands out.
Okay.
But tries to fade into the background as best as possible.
And so how was your high school experience then?
At first, it was horrible. And then it got a lot better. It did.
Why's that?
Well, at first I was raised a privileged, you know, moderately affluent white kid in, you know, a metropolitan city like Dallas, Texas, and the only experience I'd had with public school was, you know, old Saved by the Bell reruns where kids get shoved into lockers and you get beat up and bullied and everyone takes your lunch money, and I didn't have lunch money, so I was wondering what they would actually take from me, and so I really went in with my defenses on. I was a big boy at that point, a solid 280, and no one really messed with me, and I just kept everyone at a distance. I came out of my shell later in high school, and I actually came out officially about two-thirds of the way through my junior year, and everybody knew I was the only openly gay kid in high school my senior year. And then I really blossomed. I just have the standard gay story. I found theater, and I loved that, and I could be myself and be crazy and scream on stage and then go back to being a complete mute, and I got every single part I wanted because I would just awe everybody, all the students that were used to me sitting in the back of the class and literally not talking. I'd get on stage for the audition and just go absolutely ballistic, and just from the sheer shock value, they would always cast me in the parts I wanted. So, yeah,
I
got nice and manipulative and got everything I wanted, and I had a wonderful high school experience once I finally went to public school. I made friends. My best friend that I made the first year that I went there, she's still my best friend. She lives just a couple minutes away, we moved, so she lives about 30 minutes away from me now, which is sad. But, you know, it's over a decade of friendship. It's the best thing that I've ever done with my life, probably.
Wow. So in this environment where you were, you know, you were just one of the few white kids in the school, and it was a real urban, you know, inner city type of school, right? Is that what you're saying?
You know, it's hard for, in my experience, and my best friend is Black, and she says that we went to one of the most ghetto high schools that you could imagine, but it was North Dallas, you know, sort of dense suburbs, not quite urban, and it didn't feel inner city. It was just sort of located in the middle of this really awkward place where, you know, there were poor black kids that were in there. And then I was literally on the edge of the school district. And so there were a lot of, you know, overprivileged white kids that were there too, but just not that many. So it was just, it was a funny mix of high school people.
Yeah. Well, I'll ask a little more about that. But in the meantime, by then, had you distanced yourself from the youth groups at church? Did you have the Mormon experience of really having all your friends be Mormons or anything like that? It sounds like that wasn't your experience so much.
No, I think in hindsight, it seems as though socially, my dad kind of withdrew from the church. We'd still attend, but it didn't seem as though we were spending a lot of time with other families in the church, or he didn't handle the divorce very well. He was angry. I mean, you know, who can blame him getting cheated on? There's two sides to every story, but, and I think he withdrew a little bit socially. So I don't think I had the standard gay Mormon experience at all.
And you weren't really doing consistent attendance at mutual activities and stuff. The deal was you attended on Sunday, but not really that you go to all the...
Well, and I do my Boy Scouts through the church, and I'd go to the Boy Scout camps over the summer, you know, the 7-day times of fun when they threw me, a 200-something-pound kid, into a lake fully clothed and made me take off my jeans and use them as a flotation device. That was a humbling experience for me, to say the least.
Well, yeah, so it wasn't fond memories anyway, the youth activities.
Oh, no. Not fond memories at all.
So really by high school, it was sort of, you were sort of really emotionally beyond your Mormon experience.
I really was. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I wasn't the strongest kid. I think I almost used it as a bargaining chip. I think I thought that people would find it interesting that I was a Mormon, and so I'd throw that out there really quickly, and everybody likes to, you know, joke around with the minority religion, so I'd gather people around. I'm not proud of it, but I'd do it.
Well, you don't need to be embarrassed by it either. That's universal, especially when you're a teenager. Just try to get anything that'll...
Yeah, it's almost like teenage currency, you know?
Yeah. So you discovered drama, you know?
Yes.
That happened to me. And this just was the first time where you really kind of managed to break out of your shell, in a certain context. And so,
in a certain context, yeah. I was still pretty much a mute until my late in my junior year. But I would go crazy on stage. I had fun. I was Ophelia, my first big stage role in the, you know, in makeshift stage in the library. I was Ophelia in sort of a... complete works of William Shakespeare abridged. So actually, technically, my first role was dressing in drag.
So that's interesting.
Very telling.
They couldn't find somebody more...
Well, the role called for a man playing a woman. It was sort of like a theatric kind of weird play. And it was supposed to be about three guys putting on every single Shakespeare play. And we just extended it. So it was the part was for a boy. But a girl could have played it, but I was the only boy that auditioned for it, and I nailed it. I did.
Well, how'd you do? How were you as Ophelia?
Well, you know, honestly, it's really hard to tell. Everybody said I did amazing, but I think everybody was mostly... people would literally come up and tell me that they... When I was out and had friends and all of that my senior year in high school, people would come up and tell me that they thought that I was going to bring a gun to school and massacre everyone. They would. They did, because I'd sit in the corner. I wouldn't talk. And I think everybody was all just, you know, enamored with the fact that this kid who was quiet and hardly ever spoke was on stage. I mean, for Ophelia, you know, she drowns in the end of the play, and for that I just literally threw a glass of water in my face and screamed for about 5 minutes at the very top of my lungs. And so I don't know if I did all that well. I think I'm a pretty bad actor, but I was willing to do a lot of the stuff that other kids were too embarrassed to do, so...
I mean, that's interesting that you were so terribly withdrawn in school, but yet you could really just be that uninhibited on stage. I'm not surprised the other kids were impressed by that, thinking that you were just this possibly scary individual, and they turned out you were a real person. And
yeah.
So that must have been...
I was just terrified of them.
Yeah. Well, that must have been, seemed like sort of a, what do you know, an ugly duckling story, because you also came out of the closet to your school.
I didn't do some sweeping thing in the newspaper, but, you know, in high school, word travels fast, and I made two really close friends the end of my junior year, and over the summer before my senior year, I lost a whole bunch of weight, and, you know, of course, one of my friends that was the first time I really came out to friends was just before that summer, and they were like, we have to take you shopping. So they took me shopping and got me a new wardrobe, and I came back, and everybody noticed that I was skinnier, and was dressing different, and I, of course, you know, shallow as it is, I was just more comfortable with myself, though. I made a whole bunch more friends, and then I sort of began the process at the beginning of that year of slowly coming out. I would, outside of school, I, you know, got fake IDs and would sneak into the gay club and, you know, go down to the gayborhood and sit at the coffee shop and just hang out every day after school and try and spend as much...
This was during your senior year.
Yeah, this was during my senior year. And as I went through slowly, I'd sort of tell my friends, you know, oh, I went to this gay club last night, it was fun. And I never actually said I'm gay, I just sort of put the information out there slowly, and it spread like a fungus. And
wow.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to live in a time and a place and go to school in a place where it was really, you know, I say 50-50, but it was probably about 70-30. 70% were supportive and fine and or, you know, wanted to be friends with the gay kid because it was cool. And then, you know, there were about 30% that were praying for my soul. And I only had one guy hassle me. And I don't even think he was doing it because I was gay. He just didn't like me. So I was privileged. Really, really, really privileged.
Yeah. But I'm just trying to imagine this whole scenario. So you went on a crash diet, or you started exercising like crazy, or what did you do to lose all that weight?
You know, I wish I had a really exciting story, but I just did the low carb diet. My mom sort of introduced me to it. In my childhood, my parents had tried to get me to lose weight. I was sent to hypnotists, and I was given packets of pills I was supposed to take four times a day that would kill my appetite, and you know, all sorts of things that would just turn me into an emotional wreck. And honestly, I genuinely believe that my troubles with myself and, you know, my weight problem was a manifestation of my feelings towards my sexuality, because I didn't have a problem. I didn't think that I was wrong, but bottling it up just, it sucks, you know, and it's scary, and I came out to those friends towards the end of my junior year, and I'd been on that diet for a while, and I'd lost weight, but literally over those, 2.5 months of summer, I turned into a completely different person. I did. It just fell off of me. It was bonkers. It was crazy.
But then all these things piled up together. You lost the weight. You had some new confidence. You were involved in drama. So you looked like a different person. You looked like someone who had really, really transformed or come out of your cocoon. And this made you, this further, what do you have, played off itself, because then the people around you in your school were suddenly interested in you. And so they were, you know, giving you positive feedback and interacting with you. And you were getting lots of messages, I'm sure, about, you know, how fitting in better. And I'm just guessing that that also boosted your confidence a ton, which helped you even be more, you know, what do you call it, gregarious, more charismatic. And so it sounds like it was a great sort of, would have made a great movie. It should be a movie.
Have a movie
about this.
I don't know.
Well, there have been lots of movies about that, you know, about, you know, the person who just goes through this transformation that is mostly internal, but it might involve a few external things, such as, you know, really getting control over something that had been plaguing you so long, trying to lose the weight.
Oh, it took me a long time to get control over that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, because I still struggled with it, because I didn't know about how to continue to be healthy, because at some point you have to eat a carbohydrate. And,
right.
But, you know, it's not even that I felt like a new person, I genuinely was. I just, the person that I was in my adolescence, I just, is so far and away from what I feel like now, and, you know, I have a whole bunch of respect for what I've gone through, but it really feels like a different set of experiences, somebody else's experiences. So,
yeah,
I don't know, maybe I'm approaching my 30s, so I'm having all of these weird life thoughts. You might have to excuse me a couple times in this interview.
Well, I mean, we are what we are now, and the person that we were then is certainly brought us to where we are. But yeah, it's hard for anyone to say that they were the same person. But when you see someone go through such a dynamic, incredible blossoming or emerges from a cocoon, I can really see feeling disconnected from the person you were before. Although I suspect sometimes you can still remember the pains and the vulnerabilities you felt just the same.
Yeah, and that summer before my senior year really is this just odd, extraordinarily clear marker of when everything, my life completely transformed into something else. So, and you know, some of it was amazing and some of it was horrible and a lot of really bad decisions followed. But, you know, well, I think that's most people in their early 20s.
Well, let's go on with that then. So you finished college, I'm sorry, you finished high school and you were finally sort of in a good place. And I suspect that your family noticed and I was suspecting were happy for you and that. Were they happy for you? For you being as an out gay man, or was that a struggle with your parents?
They didn't know.
Okay, you didn't tell them.
No, they were still in the dark about it.
But they were noticing, though, the changes in you and your...
For sure.
Okay.
Yeah, and my demeanor and my appearance. Yeah, everything. It was a big change. My whole family was... And, you know, I had so much support the entire time. My mom never pushed me to... you know, go on a diet. She just sort of introduced me to the information. She gave me the information, and she learned it all herself, I think, behind the scenes and didn't tell me. So whenever I had a question about it, I could ask her, but she made the entire endeavor my choice, and it was my journey and my goal as far as the diet went. So I never felt like she was trying to shape me or turn me skinny or anything like that. She really put the entire experience in my hands and was sort of just, you know, a person that stood by to guide me if I had questions or... And she was crazy. She would bring me no-carb lunches to school in the middle of the day, like a couple days a week, and make me special dinners that my brother didn't have, you know, different options. Okay. She was just, I was very lucky.
So you chose the quest, but she gave you the support you needed to really kind of make it happen.
She did.
Information and emotional support and also some real logistical support. But it's nice that you didn't have to doubt that you had to succeed at this to maintain her love, at least.
Yes, from both parents.
So tell me then, what did you do after graduating from high school?
Way too many drugs.
Okay, so let me just guess. You were having so much fun in high school that you met all the partiers, and that started to get a little bit too fun. Am I guessing right?
It sounds so cliche when you put it like that. I thought I was living the life I was destined to live.
So, tell me about it. How did you get into drugs?
Well, it was funny in high school, you know, especially the house I lived in, my, you know, mildly affluent suburban little home that my mom had and my stepdad at the time. I had those, you know, list of 258 best colleges in the country, and I'd go through and only earmark the pages that said gay friendly, and then I'd go back through those earmarked pages and look at locations, and my mom was wonderful and flew me around the country to check out a few of them. And I was planning on going to Boston for college, and I submitted my application and decided to say that I didn't want to go after that. I think I was seeking out sort of a gay life, and I started making friends in the gay community, and you know, my frequent jaunts down to the gayborhood, and I would skip school. My senior year was also plagued with, I almost dropped out, actually. I barely graduated. And I really went downhill my senior year. It wasn't drugs, but I stopped caring about any of it. Really, I thought I was living the life that I was supposed to live. I had my gay friends, and I just thought, you know, why would I leave all of this? I didn't know that it was plausible to start a new life somewhere else. And after I had just finally got to a point where I felt at least, you know, 1/16th of the way decent about myself, I just didn't want to leave that. And I was scared I'd go back to being the kid who would bring an AK-47 to school. And I was terrified of that. I didn't want to be that person again, and I still didn't quite have the appropriate social skills. So I was scared.
This was the first time in your life where you kind of felt good about where you were, and so you didn't want to go risking that. And you were also really compelled to hang out in the gay scene, which...
Yeah, I had my gay friends.
You had a great time. Yeah. So you decided to just keep living with your folks and stay home and...
Yeah, I decided that, and of course I had to get a job, so I went out and got a job and moved out of the house, got my first apartment, And just how I got into drugs was actually, funnily enough, it's almost poetic. The night of my high school graduation, my good friend outside of high school that was a year beneath me, who I'd met in the neighborhood, brought crystal meth over. And so that was the first time I'd ever done anything. And then it was just, it was downhill from there. It was a pretty fast decline into misery, though. So I was fairly lucky. I had a brief, you know, very involved and very serious stint with my, with about the hardest drugs that I knew that I would ever get into. And then I just sort of reeled it back later.
Okay, so how long did that last?
From 1918 until just before my 21st birthday. About a month before my 21st birthday in late January.
You went out, you went, lived on your own, and you were just really into the parties and the drugs, and you were just supporting it by working.
Yes, and being stupid.
Jobs. And so what, did something happen? Did you hit a bottom? Did you, were you getting in trouble with the drugs? What made you decide to quit?
I've always been weird about stopping things, and people always ask me, looking back, about my weight loss, and they just ask, you know, what was that turning point? And there wasn't one. I think one day I was ready, and I was just done with it. I can't remember any specific circumstances surrounding it, and I was in a druggy haze, but I know one of the last times was when I stayed up by myself and smoked way too much, and actually fell asleep. And then woke up about 6 hours later and realized that you're not supposed to sleep on crystal meth. And I was felt very lucky to be alive in that moment. And that was one of the, you know, I still tried to convince myself that there was a way that I could, you know, live my life and manage my life and continue to use drugs. And eventually I just came to the decision that it wasn't there and I stopped. And then I moved on to other stuff.
Well, we'll get to that, but but tell me a little bit about drugs. For those who've never really had experience with drugs, were you using drugs because it was fun? Were you using drugs because you needed the euphoria? Were you using drugs because you needed to escape? How would you kind of? I mean, I guess it's more complicated than just an easy sentence like that. But what would you say? What was the kind of thing that you were getting out of the drugs?
I really think what I was getting out of the drugs was that when I'd use them, I wouldn't feel like that kid that's sitting in the back of the classroom and scared of everyone and doesn't know how to interact and talk, and literally to the point where someone would come up and say, "Hi, how are you?" I wouldn't even respond to them. I wouldn't know how to. I wouldn't know what to say, and it really assuaged all of those fears. It took them away and, you know, replaced it with crazy, obsessive-compulsive behaviors. I mean, it's just, I'm sorry, to me, crystal meth is not a party drug. I would sit in my room for like 6 hours at a time on one stupid project. I'd have six to-do lists going at a different time. I had one to-do list about to-do lists I needed to make. I mean, it was just, you get to a point where you just stop and think, what am I doing here? So,
And so crystal meth was always your drug of choice.
It was, and then I switched to, it's been such a long time since I've discussed this, but I switched about halfway through, probably in my early 20s, to GHB, and then I had way too much fun with that, and that's one of the, and that's when I ended up stopping about a couple weeks before my 21st birthday. I loved my GHB.
Yeah. is that for the hallucinatory effects? I guess I haven't done it, so I...
No, it's sort of like this, it's a liquid that apparently is easy to manufacture. I never tried, but it pretty much makes you feel like you're drunk, but you just have a lot more control over your motor functions, and that for me was perfect because I tried to drink when I was 17, and, you know, I remember showing up completely plastered at my very first gay party because I was scared and took like six shots of vodka, and the only thing that I knew to combine with vodka was tomato juice because I knew about the drink Bloody Mary, so I'd take shots of vodka and chase it with tomato juice, and I got way too drunk, went to a gay party, fell over, and grabbed a guy's freshly broken foot that had not yet been cast, And he let out a screech like a wild animal I've never heard in my entire life. And then I went outside and threw up in the bushes. So I never could quite handle my alcohol, so I needed to move on to something that didn't quite make me as crazy.
Okay. And during this time, were you, you know, were you having boyfriends? Were you...
Yeah,
you
I had
submerged
a...
Submerged in basically the gay scene? Was, would you say that you were really part of the gay ghetto at the time?
I had a boyfriend my senior year in high school. I felt so proud. We broke up just before the prom, too. And I knew from the rules that I wasn't supposed to take a boy to prom, but I was determined to do it. But I wouldn't do it unless it was an actual boyfriend. I didn't want to bring a gay friend, and that would just, you know, it really needed to be authentic, and the cards just didn't fall correctly. And I so wish I could have had an amazing kicked out of prom gay story, but we broke up a couple weeks before that, unfortunately.
Did he go to your same school?
No, he didn't. He was 19. He was out of high school and sort of couch surfing and friends in the gayborhood, and he'd been kicked out of his home. And it's always just so funny, you know, in the gay world, those are just the most exotic. And at that time, a lot of the guys you met were kind of doing that. If they decided to try and live a gay life, they were just jumping from couch to couch around the gayborhood and trying to make it. And that was him, and yeah. I thought it was so exotic, and I was in love for about 3 weeks.
And you almost went to the prom, but didn't quite make it.
No, he found out that he was HIV positive about at one point after we'd fooled around, and that was my first fun gay experience. It was my first guy I'd ever dated or, you know, had a crush on that it actually turned into anything, and we luckily hadn't had sex, but we'd fooled around, and he... came out that he was HIV positive, and tons of fun.
So that put a little bit of fear of reality into you. I mean, it sounds like an experience like that, if you would hopefully help you at least make some wise decisions, even if you're making bad decisions about drugs, making some wise decisions about protecting yourself. Did it have that effect for you?
You would think. Well, you know what? Yeah, it really did. As far as relationships and sex went, it really did. I kind of turned into a bit of a Nazi, but that's one of the weird things from...
Well, when you say Nazi, that's a good thing to be when it comes to safe sex.
Yes.
I would encourage everyone to be absolutely, you know, strict as can be on that. But
safe sex. I mean, you know, my first boyfriend when I was 19 years old, or when I was 17, 18 years old, turned out to be HIV positive. I mean, you just can't be too careful. It's right. Just not, you know, if a kid that young has managed to contract it, you just, yeah, it's important to be responsible for, it just is.
Well, I'm glad you were, because it's easier to get over a drug addiction than a serious medical illness that you have to carry all your life. And so I just want to encourage people to really, really learn about safe sex and protect themselves all the time, and regardless of what your intentions are about how much you're going to act out sexually, please get educated. But
yes, and find someone also. I mean, friends, it's funny, when that happened to me, I remember it was over, but he told me to meet him at his brother's house, and I drove about 140 down the freeway. My friends were in the car with me. They were terrified for their lives. I was kind of beside myself, and went in, and his brother sort of gave us a rundown of all of the information that we needed, and because his older brother was gay too, and he went there and he was like, well, you guys had oral sex and, you know, this percent chance of something, and this is what I've read about this. And it's funny, my senior year in high school, they came into my economics class and had a sex ed seminar where they discussed outer course as a viable alternative to sex. So instead of having intercourse, you have outer course, which is essentially keeping your clothes on and just rubbing together really hard. And, okay. And it's my senior year in high school, and I'm thinking, you know, I have a boyfriend. 70% of graduating seniors, and these kids are all about to graduate, at that time, were graduating having lost their virginity. And you're sitting here talking to a room of 70% not virgins about not having sex. I mean, it was just, I was the kid that wanted to pass out condoms. It's just, it was all silly. You know, your trusted individuals aren't going to talk to you, then you need to talk to somebody about it.
And in this case, it was the brother of your boyfriend who turned out to be HIV positive who
yes.
helped you educate yourself about what you needed to know about safe sex then.
Yeah, about safe sex and, you know, in the early 2000s. In a weird way, it was still sort of fresh off of the, you know, scare in the 80s. And so, yeah, he gave me the information that I needed to both of us, and all about HIV and what our chances were, and I needed to get tested. And the only place I knew where to go was Planned Parenthood, so I went there. And, yeah, it was definitely a crash course. It happened very quickly.
And it was it that old thing where you had to wait 2 weeks to get your results? Or?
Yes, I had to wait. I don't think, was it 2 weeks? It was such a long time ago and I was terrified, but I had to wait. And I knew that my chances were slim since we hadn't actually had intercourse, but, and honestly, as far as the data and the information that his brother told me, it just, I wasn't terrified, but I didn't want to worry any of my friends. I went all by myself and just handled it, and they were all scared for me, and, you know, one day over coffee, I told them I wasn't positive, and they cried. They were very relieved. So, yeah, it's a...
Okay, well... That's a rough thing that, unfortunately, the young people still need to think about, and too many of them aren't these days. It's become people don't realize how hard it is to manage that illness. I mean, it doesn't kill quite as fast as it did, but it's still really, really hard to manage being on a chronic illness where you have to take chronic medications, where you can't miss them, where the medications have side effects, where you have to incorporate this into every decision of your life about partners and sex. And so I know that there's a lot of people who have amazing lives who are HIV positive, but I really, really want young people to be aware of that this is still something they need to take very, very seriously.
Yeah, of course, the prognosis is so much better today than it was, but I mean, the prognosis is still being chained to meds like 4 times a day and constant doctor's visits and, you know, self-maintenance and making sure that, you know, it's to me, it sounds like being almost imprisoned, you know? And of course the prognosis is better, but when the reality of it is, it's fundamentally changes how you are allowed to live your life. It just, I mean, I don't know if you can.
It impacts every relationship.
Every single thing.
It's certainly if you can avoid it. I mean, people get illnesses, right? People get diabetes, people get cancer, they don't have any control. And some people have gotten this and they no longer have the choice. But I want to speak to those who haven't got it yet, that you can prevent it and you should. So that's...
And there's no reason not to. There's just not. I mean, if you can give yourself
there's
a good
plenty
reason.
Of really fun things to do.
Yeah.
That are safe, so.
There are tons of options.
Okay, well, let's go on then. So you decided to get yourself clean and sober, but you tell me you didn't quite get yourself healthy. You found other ways of... Is that what you were implying a minute ago when you...
You know, I just stopped. After that, I struggled with alcohol. I wasn't clean and sober. I did struggle with alcohol and had problems there because I just didn't quite want to be myself, but eventually... I was raised, on my mom's part at least, with a very casual attitude towards alcohol. She would offer it to us at dinner and, you know, do you guys want wine? And we'd all say, no, that's gross. But it was just sort of, you know, demystified for us when we were kids. And so it wasn't something that I enjoyed. It wasn't something that I liked. And I tried to get myself completely sandbagged and out of my own head and body, but it just wasn't something I was happy with. So
you didn't quit drugs in the context of a 12-step program, obviously. You just quit and turned to something else.
I just quit and turned to something else, and then that something else kind of sucked, so I just smoked a lot of cigarettes and was an emotional wreck. And I would still drink, of course, but I wasn't, you know, having shots of whiskey at cereal time or anything.
Okay.
But no, the 12 steps actually, funnily enough, came when I moved out to Phoenix to be a counselor at a transitional living community. And that's
what inspired you to do that, to change cities and to change?
My brother struggled with drugs. He died of a drug overdose. And my aunt, you know, nepotism is the backbone of the American workforce, it's sort of a small transitional living community out in Phoenix, Mandalay Village. So it was a wonderful place to work, and she took me out there. And while I was out there, I didn't touch a substance once, because it just felt really fraudulent. And I talked to people about my experiences and my life, and I was actually supposed to go out there to sort of be like a lifestyle coordinator and talk to, because one of the big things for me was being able to, because of course, you know, while I was doing all of these drugs and while I was trying to stabilize myself and get to some place where I was at least remotely happy with myself, I was also doing incredibly unhealthy things to maintain my weight. Crystal meth was one of them. It made me not eat, so I really liked that. I remember when one of my high school friends taught me how to be bulimic. That was sort of an awkward memory to have because I remember it so vividly, but I struggled with that for a long time. I tried to be anorexic, but I was so hungry. And after 2 weeks, I couldn't do it anymore. And I really found sort of health, nutrition, how to, you know, apply that to your life. And that really made me feel a lot more whole. I went to culinary school and really loved doing that. And that's where I really learned about food and, you know, how to eat.
Did you do that in Phoenix then?
I didn't do that. I did that a couple years before Phoenix.
Okay. So that was part of your journey to getting healthy then. You decided to take a healthier approach to maintain your weight by eating healthy.
Yes. And also so to, it was sort of an approach to maintaining my life. And it was really effective. I was in a relationship with a great guy at the time who stayed with me the entire time I was through Phoenix, and we struggled, and he was just, and I really loved that man. And, I was still struggling a little bit with trying to accept myself, and I would still, you know, drink at weird times, and I was trying to teach myself all about this health and nutrition stuff to be able to manage my life. And slowly, you know, I was almost motivated by this great guy in my life to try and make myself a better person. And when I got the offer to go to Phoenix, I just told him, I literally cannot pass up this opportunity. I can't. But the funny thing is when you talk to recovering addicts and alcoholics who have just got out of rehab about exercise and healthy eating, they mostly flick lit cigarettes at you. So my job was rendered obsolete fairly quickly, but apparently I showed some sort of, you know, propensity for being able to. I've always been told I have a very calming influence on people and that I sort of settle everyone down and help them feel like everything's going to be okay. And I don't know about that, but my aunt likes what I contributed. So I loved being there. I wish I could have stayed there longer.
But you had kind of gotten yourself clean, sober or mostly sober, just on your own. You had taken a approach to health and well-being through your diet and food and your culinary experience, and that makes sense because you had used food in a really unhealthy way. And so, but you'd never actually sort of done a program that was structured or that was, you know, a recovery program, but you went to work one. So I'm guessing there that you must have learned a lot about it by actually working it.
Well, you know, it was fascinating for me. I really thought it was a cool concept. I actually went through the 12 steps while I was counseling. So it was almost like I was doing it with all of the clients at the same time. And my focus was less on, you know, staying away from substances, because genuinely I got out there and there wasn't a craving. There wasn't any worry that, you know, I wasn't going to get high in some way, shape, or form. I really liked my healthy lifestyle, and so it was just sort of a fascinating experience to be experiencing what the clients that I was talking to, you know, going through the same steps that they were going through. My focus was more on sort of discovering my spirituality and connection with God and whatever that meant. The regimented part and the lifestyle I'd sort of gotten down with my food and eating, and that helped me to feel a lot better about myself. And I got in ridiculously good shape when I was out there, so that helped me to feel really good about it.
An exercise program.
Yes, I joined a gym. I started working out earlier when, you know, and trying to figure out how to do it. But I've always been kind of shy, and I got my gym membership, and I would drive all the way from the house I was staying at to the gym, and drive straight through the parking lot and all the way back home. And I think I did that route about 6 times before I actually got the balls to park and go in and work out. Wow. So it was a long process for me, but I feel,
yeah,
you know, I guess the process just never quite ends.
But for you, it all came together. I mean, the physical health, more than most addicts, was probably really, really relevant to your staying healthy. And so
that
you added that element into it, the exercise. But tell me a little bit about the spiritual part. I mean, that's obviously a big part of the 12-step programs, but do you mind being a little bit personal about what happened with your spiritual journey then?
No, not at all. To me, spirituality is so broad and also so intensely personal, and just a connection with God, period. I kind of assume that there's a lot of emotion that people have as far as that are wrapped up in their own feelings towards themselves and about life and their own lives that sort of get channeled into how they assume God acts and feels and is. And so, you know, I ask you to for sure ask whatever questions you're interested in. I think it's so personal. For me, I kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, like I had said when I was a kid in the Mormon church, I just felt like it was a waste of time to be there for 4 hours a week when they were telling you to try and be a good person. And to me, that felt very cut and dry. You know, you be a good person, you're in God's good graces, or at least try to, you know, and he or she or it knows your intentions and follow through with that. And so to this day, I try really hard in every instance to be as good of a person as, you know, I can be, and I fail all the time. But as far as searching for him, I kind of found him outside. I found him when I was hiking in the mountains. I'd never lived outside of Dallas, so really in Arizona, they're big hills. But I went there, and I had my, I can't remember the AA jargon. What is the name? Your sponsor. I can't believe, oh, I am so sorry, Sean Mahoney, if you end up listening to this, that I couldn't remember the name, the word sponsor. My sponsor was friggin' amazing. She was just she's one of the coolest people I've ever met in my entire life, and she helped me through it. And I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I totally invite you to ask me questions about it, because for me, I could just, you know, mumble aimlessly for a long time. That's what I think spirituality is.
Did you have any particular affirming moments where you really felt a divine presence, where you felt something, or you felt an answer, or you gave a prayer, or made a prayer, or made a plea, anything like that? That
no, I don't. In my experience, I haven't felt these big interventions from some higher power. I'm just honestly, I'm not. I don't quite believe in believing. For me, I think it's really important for everybody to be true to themselves and their own spiritual path and whatever they feel in their hearts, for them to go for it, because it's for you and it's for your world and how you live in it. And it's important. For me, I kind of got to this point towards the end of my 12 steps where I sort of just thought, you know, if there's something out there, which I kind of assume there is, but I completely leave the possibility for there being nothing out there open, because I don't know. But if there is something, I would assume that us to know it personally, or at least have information about it, it would have happened by now. And it seems so silly for me to be questing to get to know this, you know, being that floats around out in the universe or is underneath our feet or wherever, when I'll figure it out when I die. To me, it seems like the most important part is spending as much time of your life as you can happy. I mean, the world is a gift, and, you know, we need to take care of it, and our lives are gifts, and the people that we're in it are gifts, and to me, the point is spend as much time, for me, as much time happy while you're here as you possibly can. That is just the ultimate goal, and, you know, being a good person makes me really happy, and doing nice things for people, it's...
Well, maybe I'm taking things out of order, but yeah, why don't you talk a little bit more about what would be your advice to someone on how to be happy then, based on what you've learned?
Trust yourself and trust your instincts and trust your gut. If you can't figure that out by yourself, then find someone to talk to about it. Have a dialogue. For me, being able to... I was lucky to be in this transitional living community, 6 to 8 houses with 4 people in each house, you know, all of whom were sitting around talking to each other about God and their relationship with their higher power. And, you know, being able to discuss with people and understanding how they feel really helps you to understand that there are so many different approaches to how to cope with this world that we live in. And people have good advice and they have good feelings. And I just don't think there's a right or wrong. I think it's what works for you. And I think, you know, if there is a God, he would want us to spend as much time on this world happy as humanly possible. And I would think that that's what we need to be searching for, you know, more of a focus on contentment. So that's just sort of my focus now. I'll say nice little shout outs when good things happen. And As far as divine intervention goes, I always have these weird moments where, and I question myself where, you know, if I'm at work and think, oh, well, you know, I should fill up that water, and someone, and then I decide not to and be lazy, and someone says, can you fill up my water? And I just say, oh, I should have done it. To me, I try and figure out if there's a rhyme or reason to this world. Like, am I just being taught a lesson about laziness? And so it's just this, for me, it's kind of a game. I'm not worried about going to hell. I'm not worried about some evil, you know, horrible thing telling me I didn't do a good enough job. I'm just going to be happy and be respectful of everything that, or try at least to be respectful of everything I've been given by whatever it is that's out there, and try and treat it with as much love and compassion as I can. And, you know, that's just that of it. And I think I'll be fine. I'm just not too worried about it.
And so when you talk about the spiritual discoveries you made when you were working that program, how would you describe that? You said a lot of it was maybe on your nature walks or encounters with nature that helped you feel divinity or helped you feel spiritual, or...
Yeah, meditation was a lot of fun. For me, the most important thing really was the interaction with others and realizing that there are so many different paths to, you know, finding spirituality within yourself. There are billions of different ways that people employ to try and, you know, get that inner peace that they're questing for, that connection to their higher power, that understanding of life and the universe and what's actually going on. There are billions of different ways that people come to that conclusion and find whatever they're looking for. And to say that one way is right, I think is really just silly and closed-minded. You know, I think there's amazing things and amazing lessons to learn from everyone. And for me, it was experiencing each individual's, anything that they felt had got them to the place that they wanted to be at. And I listened to the advice of others because I think they know better than me. And to me, you know, they've been put on this earth with me somehow for some reason. And I listen.
I really agree with that, that there is so much beauty in having a connection with another person and connecting, you know, in those kind of situations, or any kind of situation, in a friendship, but even in a place where you're counseling someone, or and I'm a psychiatrist, so I obviously have found myself counseling people, but I really find the times where I'm most helpful, but also when it's most satisfying to me, is when I'm really having a two-way conversation. So I'm not just helping someone, but they're helping me. I'm really listening to them in such a way that I'm taking in what they're telling me too. And so it sounds like you grabbed onto that a little, that idea a little bit when you were there, not only helping them, but helping yourself and getting help from the people you were actually there to help, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, I just, people have things to offer. People have happiness. People have characteristics that I admire. And, you know, people have characteristics sometimes that I envy. So I just think it's important. My mom always taught me to heal with humor, and, you know, that lesson has lasted me my entire life. It's important to laugh at all, you know, yeah, horrible things you've gone through or anything like that. I just think everybody has something to offer, and for me, it's about listening to what others have to say.
Well, I want to put this in perspective with some of your life events a little bit. You said your brother died of a drug overdose. Was this later, or was this earlier?
This was about 4 years ago, so it was literally, it wasn't even a year after he died that I went to Phoenix.
Okay, so he had died, so did that play a role in your journey, just seeing what had happened to him?
Logistically and technically, yes. My aunt and I hadn't had a very close relationship, and we'd hardly talked, and when she came from the funeral, we had an opportunity to sit down and sort of discuss my life and what I'd been going through, and I try to be open with all of the bad, just because I think it's silly to not be. I think it's really silly to hide it all, and I think she just saw something in me and appreciated that, because I'm not too afraid to share the nitty-gritty of life. I like to cut through the crap a lot of the time, and I think she liked that,
yeah.
So.
Okay.
You know, and one could easily say that that was divine intervention. That, you know, something beautiful came out of his death, and, you know, yeah. With my brother, it was funny, because I never really was sad that he died. I was sad for me and my mom and my dad and my whole family. I was just so sad for him, and the circumstances surrounding it were just I mean, sort of oddly picturesque. But I never really felt sad that he was gone. He was a happy guy, but he had such an amazing high school career, and he went to Duke and studied linguistics and spent a year in Italy and traveled the world and fraternities and had, and he was tortured. And he didn't have to deal with that torture anymore. He'd led such an amazing life, and I just don't know if there was, you know, as far as a ratio of happiness versus sadness, I think he would, had he been able to stay and claw through those 12 steps and work with the sponsor and talk to counselors and have relapses and destroy everything and, you know, his life and hurt his family and then get back to, I just don't quite know if it was worth it, if it would have been worth it for him to have stuck around and tried. I think he'd had an amazing life, and I'm so glad that he, wherever he is, he's not tortured anymore. There's nothing that makes me happier. I feel so sad for my family, but I'm so sad, happy that he doesn't have to suffer.
So you really saw him really on a roller coaster then, because he had done amazing things, but also had really, really struggled a lot with his issues and with his drug problem.
Oh, yeah. Well, he lived with me the year before he died. We actually moved into an apartment together. And he's the best roommate I've ever had, but I also got to experience that downward spiral firsthand, and it was ugly. And so maybe some of that, you know, helped me to come to that happy conclusion. And maybe it's just a coping mechanism, but, you know, whatever it does, I feel better about it.
Yeah. So you really saw him go through a demise?
Oh, yeah. It was scary. It really was. I had to kick him out at one point because he had cocaine and crystal meth in our apartment, and I was... It had been years since I'd done it, but I didn't want that stuff around me ever again. And I told him I couldn't have that. I couldn't know that it was hidden in the apartment somewhere. I might go, I didn't think I'd go looking for it, but you know, one day when you're sad or just not yourself, I just didn't want to take the chance. And he wasn't supposed to be using in the first place.
Yeah. And when you were living together, I mean, at this point you were, is that around the time you were doing the culinary school? You were trying to get yourself healthy at the time? And
yes.
And he was giving you a contrasting sort of perspective, I'm guessing, going sort of the other way, going down instead of up.
Kind of. I mean, it wasn't this giant cliff that he fell off of. It was, you know, at least there were a couple stops along the way, and then it'd level off, and then it'd be a cliff again. So there were periods of peace and times when he and I had so much fun, and it was one of the coolest years of my entire life. And then the week before he died New Year's Day, and the Christmas before he died, it was so funny because he hadn't spoken to my father in like 10 years, 8 years maybe. And my mom and I went with my dad to the Christmas Symphony, and I guess that sort of made him realize that it was all sort of silly that he'd cut dad out of his life for such a long time. And he actually came over for Christmas, and then mom came over with him, and it, for the first time literally that I could remember, my entire family was in one place. No one hated anyone, everyone was okay with everyone, and we had a lovely Christmas. And then like 4 days later,
Whoa.
He died. Well, 6 days, I guess, five and a half. And so yeah, I was so glad to have that moment. That year of my life was, that's why I say it was oddly picturesque. It was just sort of, it was perfect and it was poetic, and, you know, looking back, it was this really fascinating marker where my life completely changed. I got away from Dallas for the first time. I went to Phoenix. I came home. I got, you know, a job making money. I met the most amazing man I've ever met in my entire life, and I'm married and a stepdad, and that's down the road. But, you know, it's just a really cool time to be able to look back on and be grateful for.
Right.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see the podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation today at gaymormonstories.org. Music for this podcast was graciously donated by Nabby Parkinson Folk and Ricky Parkinson.
That thou hast shown, pause to help and finding strength beyond my own. Savior, may I learn to love thee, Lord. I would fall. walking perfectly in the quiet heart is hidden sorrow that the eye can't see. Ooh, who am I to judge?